Chapter 26. Early the next morning, a half hour ahead of the morning traffic rush, Pitt dropped Lauren off at her townhouse and drove to the NUMA headquarters building. Not about to risk damage to the Allard by the crazy drivers of the nation's capital, he drove an aging but pristine 1984 Jeep Grand Wagoneer that he had modified by installing a Rodec 500-horsepower V8 engine taken from a hot rod wrecked at a national drag race meet. The driver of a Ferrari or Lamborghini, who might have stopped beside him at a red light, would never suspect that Pitt could blow their doors off from 0 to 100 miles an hour before their superior gear ratios and wind dynamics gave them the edge. He slipped the Jeep into his parking space beneath the tall, green-glassed tower that housed NUMA's offices and took the elevator up to Yeager's computer floor. The carrying handle of the metal case containing the jade box gripped tightly in his right hand. When he stepped into a private conference room, he found Admiral Sandecker, Giordino, and Gunn already waiting for him. He set the case on the floor and shook hands. "I apologize for being late."
"You're not late."
Admiral James Sandecker spoke in a sharp tone that could slice a frozen pork roast.
"We're all early. In suspense and full anticipation about the map, or whatever you call it."
"Kipu," explained Pitt patiently. "An Inca recording device."
"I'm told the thing is supposed to lead to a great treasure. Is that true?"
"I wasn't aware of your interest," Pitt said, with the hint of a smile.
"When you take matters into your own hands on agency time and money, all behind my back, I might add, I'm giving heavy thought to placing an advertisement in the Help Wanted section for a new projects director."
"Purely an oversight, sir," said Pitt, exercising considerable willpower to keep a straight face. "I had every intention of sending you a full report."
"If I believed that," Sandecker snorted, "I'd buy stock in a buggy whip factory."
A knock came on the door, and a bald-headed, cadaverous man with a great, scraggly Wyatt Earp mustache stepped into the room. He was wearing a crisp, white lab coat. Sandecker acknowledged him with a slight nod and turned to the others.
"I believe you all know Dr. Bill Strait," he said.
Pitt extended his hand.
"Of course. Bill heads up the Marine Artifact Preservation Department. We've worked on several projects together."
"My staff is still buried under the 2 truckloads of antiquities from the Byzantine cargo vessel you and Al found embedded in the ice on Greenland a few years ago."
"All I remember about that project," said Giordino, "is that I didn't thaw out for 3 months."
"Why don't you show us what you've got?" said Sandecker, unable to suppress his impatience.
"Yes, by all means," said Yeager, polishing one lens of his granny spectacles. "Let's have a look at it."
Pitt opened the case, gently removed the jade box, and placed it on the conference table. Giordino and Gunn had already seen it during the flight from the rainforest to Quito, and they stood back while Sandecker, Yeager, and Strait moved in for a close look.
"Masterfully carved," said Sandecker, admiring the intricate features of the face on the lid.
"A most distinctive design," observed Strait. "The serene expression, the soft look of the eyes, definitely have an Asian quality about them. Almost a direct association with statuary art from the Kahola dynasty of southern India."
"Now that you mention it," said Yeager, "the face does have a remarkable resemblance to most sculptures of Buddha."
"How is it possible for 2 unrelated cultures to carve similar likenesses from the same type of stone?" asked Sandecker.
"Pre-Columbian contact by a trans-Pacific crossing," speculated Pitt.
Strait shook his head.
"Until someone discovers an ancient artifact in this hemisphere that is absolutely proven to have come from either Asia or Europe, all similarities have to be classed as sheer coincidence. No more. Likewise, no early Mayan or Andean art has ever shown up in excavations of ancient cities around the Mediterranean or the Far East," said Gunn.
"Likewise, no early Mayan or Andean art has ever shown up in excavations of ancient cities around the Mediterranean or the Far East," said Gunn. Strait lightly ran his fingertips over the green jade. Still, this face presents an enigma. Unlike the Maya and the ancient Chinese, the Inca did not prize jade. They preferred gold to adorn their kings and gods, living or dead, believing it represented the sun that gave fertility to the soil and warmth to all life. "Let's open it and get to that thing inside," ordered Sandecker. Straight nodded at Pitt. "I'll let you do the honors." Without a word, Pitt inserted a thin metal shaft under the lid of the box and carefully pried it open. There it was, the quipu, lying as it had in the cedar-lined box for centuries. They stared curiously at it for almost a minute, wondering if its riddle could be solved. Straight zipped open a small leather pouch. Neatly arrayed inside was a set of tools, several different-sized tweezers, small calipers, and a row of what looked like the picks that dentists use for cleaning teeth. He pulled on a pair of soft white gloves and selected a pair of tweezers and one of the picks. Then he reached in the box and began probing the quipu, delicately testing the strands to see if they could be separated without breaking. As if he were a surgeon lecturing to a group of interns over a cadaver, he began explaining the examination process. "Not as brittle nor as fragile as I expected. The quipu is made from different metals, mostly copper, some silver, one or two gold. Looks like they were hand-formed into wire and then wound into tiny coil-like cables, some thicker than others, with varied numbers of strands and colors. The cables still retain a measure of tensile strength and a surprising degree of resilience. There appear to be a total of 31 cables of various lengths, each with a series of incredibly small knots spaced at irregular intervals. Most of the cables are individually tinted, but a few are identical in color. The longer cables are linked to subordinates that act as modifying clauses, similar to the diagram of a sentence in an English class. This is definitely a sophisticated message that cries out to be unraveled."
"Amen," muttered Giordino.
Straight paused and turned to the Admiral. "With your permission, sir, I will remove the quipu from its resting place."
"What you're saying is that I am responsible in the event you break the damn thing," Sandecker scowled.
"Well, sir..."
"Go ahead, man, get with it. I can't stand around here all day staring at some smelly old relic."
"Nothing like the aroma of rotting mulch to put one on edge," said Pitt drolly.
Sandecker fixed him with a sour stare.
"We can dispense with the humor."
"The sooner we unsnarl this thing," said Jaeger anxiously, "the sooner I can create a decoding program."
Straight flexed his gloved fingers like a piano player about to assault Franz Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2. Then he took a deep breath and slowly reached into the box. He slipped a curved probe very carefully under several cables of the quipu and gently raised them a fraction of a centimeter.
"Score one for our side," he sighed thankfully. "After lying in the box for centuries, the coils have not fused together or stuck to the wood. They pull free quite effortlessly."
"They appear to have survived the ravages of time extremely well," observed Pitt.
After examining the quipu from every angle, Straight then slipped two large tweezers under it from opposite sides. He hesitated as if bolstering his confidence, then began raising the quipu from its resting place. No one spoke. All held their breath until Straight laid the multicolored cables on a sheet of glass. Setting aside the tweezers in favor of the dental picks, he meticulously unfolded the cables one by one until they were all spread flat like a fan.
"There it is, gentlemen," he sighed with relief. "Now we have to soak the strands in a very mild cleaning solution to remove stains and corrosion. This process will then be followed by a chemical preservation procedure in our lab.
How long before you can return it to Jaeger for study? Asked Sandecker.
Strait shrugged. 6 months, maybe a year.
You've got 2 hours, said Sandecker, without batting an eye.
Impossible. The metal coils lasted as long as they did because they were sealed in a box that was almost airtight. Now that they're fully exposed to air, they'll quickly begin to disintegrate.
Certainly not the ones spun from gold, said Pitt.
No, gold is practically indestructible. But we don't know the exact mineral content of the other tinted coils. The copper, for instance, may have an alloy that crumbles from oxidation. Without careful preservation techniques, they might decay, causing the colors to fade to the point of becoming unreadable.
Determining the color key is vital to deciphering the quipu, Gunn added.
The mood in the room had suddenly turned sour. Only Jaeger seemed immune. He wore a canny smile on his face as he gazed at Strait.
Give me 30 minutes for my scanning equipment to measure the distances between the knots and fully record the configuration, and you can keep the thing in your lab until you're old and gray.
That's all the time you'll need? Sandecker asked incredulously.
My computers can generate 3-dimensional digital images, enhanced to reveal the strands as vividly as they were when created 400 years ago.
Ah, but it soothes the savage beast, Giardino waxed poetical, to live in a modern world.
Jaeger's scan of the Drake Kipu took closer to an hour and a half, but when he was finished, the graphics made it look better than when it was brand new. 4 hours later, he made his first breakthrough in deciphering its message.
Incredible how something so simple can be so complex, he said, gazing at the vividly colored simulation of the cables that fanned out across a large monitor.
Sort of like an abacus, said Giordino, straddling a chair in Jaeger's computer sanctuary and leaning over the backrest. Only he and Pitt had remained with Jaeger. Strait had returned to his lab with the quipu, while Sandecker and Gunn went off to a Senate committee hearing on a new underwater mining project.
Far more complicated.
Pitt was leaning over Jaeger's shoulder, studying the image on the monitor.
The abacus is basically a mathematical device. The quipu, on the other hand, is a much more subtle instrument. Each color, coil thickness, placement, and type of knot, and the tufted ends all have significance. Fortunately, the Inca numerical system used a base of 10 just like ours.
Go to the head of the class, Jaeger nodded.
This one, besides numerically recording quantities and distances, also recorded a historical event. I'm still groping around in the dark, but, for example...
He paused to type in a series of instructions on his keyboard. 3 of the quipu's coils appeared to detach themselves from the main collar and were enlarged across the screen.
My analysis proves pretty conclusively that the brown, blue, and yellow coils indicate the passage of time over distance. The numerous smaller orange knots that are evenly spaced on all 3 coils symbolize the sun or the length of a day.
What brought you to that conclusion?
The key was the occasional interspacing of large white knots.
Between the orange ones?
Right. The computer and I discovered that they coincide perfectly with phases of the moon. As soon as I can calculate astronomical moon cycles during the 1500s, I can zero in on approximate dates.
Good thinking, said Pitt with mounting optimism. You're onto something.
The next step is to determine what each cable was designed to illustrate. As it turns out, the Incas were also masters of simplicity. According to the computer's analysis, the green coil represents land and the blue one the sea. The yellow remains inconclusive.
So how do you read it? Asked Giordino. Jaeger punched two keys and sat back. 24 days of travel over land, 86 by sea. 12 days in the yellow, whatever that stands for. The time spent at their destination, Pitt ventured. Jaeger nodded in agreement. That figures. The yellow coil might denote a barren land. Or a desert, said Giordino. Or a desert, Pitt repeated. A good bet if we're looking at the coast of northern Mexico. On the opposite side of the quipu, Jaeger continued, we find cables matching the same blue and green colors, but with a different number of knots. This suggests to the computer the time spent on the return trip. Judging by the additions and shorter spacing between knots, I'd say they had a difficult and stormy voyage home. It doesn't look to me as if you're groping in the dark, said Pitt. I'd say you have a pretty good grasp of it. Jaeger smiled. Flattery is always gratefully accepted. I only hope I don't fall into the trap of inventing too much of the analysis as I go. The prospect did not sit well with Pitt. No fiction, Hiram. Keep it straight. I understand. You want a healthy baby with 10 fingers and 10 toes. Preferably one holding a sign that says, Dig here, Pitt said in a cold, flat voice that almost curled Jaeger's hair. Or we'll find ourselves staring down a dry hole.